The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The Supreme Court has gone home for the summer, we think. This very significant term for the court of Chief Justice John Roberts has ended its term with two decisions, both of which seem to fully acknowledge an historic transformation in America's acceptance of homosexuality and an ongoing evolution in the definition of marriage. In a 5-4 decision, the justices have struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA. Writing for the majority, Justice Anthony Kennedy said, quote, DOMA is unconstitutional as a deprivation of the equal liberty of persons that is protected by the Fifth Amendment. The federal government has no cause to defend heterosexual marriage, the court held, and there is no demonstrable harm to citizens if people are allowed to marry whomever they wish. Now, in a second case, the court could have declared any state law banning same-sex marriage equally unconstitutional, but it did not. This was the case of California's Proposition 8. Here, the court nullified the Prop 8 ban, but on procedural grounds, tossing it back to the district court, which ruled it unconstitutional quite a while ago. What does this all mean? Catherine Franke joins us, law professor and director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia Law School. Welcome.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me on the show.
It seems as though these decisions were easy for the court to come to. The DOMA was an overreach by the federal government, according to Anthony Kennedy. The procedural case is a little curious on the Prop 8 question. What does this decision say about the court's divisions and what this says for cases going forward?
Well, we had a suspicion from the argument, the oral arguments in the DOMA case, that it was the conservative members of the court who wanted to take the DOMA case and not the more liberal members of the court, so that they could say once and for all that there was no constitutional issue here before the issue of same-sex marriage became more widely accepted in society. In some sense, I think people were thinking that the court wanted to nip this in the bud before it got any worse, that the conservative members of the court did. But that's not what happened. We actually have Justice Kennedy writing for the court and stating a very broad and expansive notion of equality for same-sex couples and denouncing bigotry and animus against people on the basis of their sexual orientation.
Although it's interesting, in the same way, by using that broad language, Kennedy, if that was his intent, seems to be nipping in the bud any other cases. The court doesn't want to have much to do with this same-sex marriage issue going forward based on at least this first decision.
Well, I think the court felt, and who knows what they really felt, but some of us have surmised that the court would rather not have had both of these cases so soon. The Supreme Court doesn't like to be out ahead of the political process and out ahead of the American people more generally. They like to see these new difficult social issues percolate for a while before they come to the Supreme Court. And in some ways, there are a number of us in the lesbian and gay community who felt that Ted Olson and David Boies, by pushing the Prop 8 case, the California case, so aggressively that it pushed the court to take both the Prop 8 and the DOMA case before the court really felt that these cases were ripe and ready.
Does that mean then that bans that might exist in other states are challengeable? And, you know, there was an anomaly in California. The state chose not to defend the Prop 8 law, so that created the procedural door that the court drove through here. Does that mean that some of these other bans will be challenged and that this case will come up again?
Well, the other bans would have been challenged no matter how the cases came out today. What we really have is a 50-state strategy going from the most progressive to the less progressive states, trying to raise the question of a right to marriage state by state based on local norms and traditions and where the people in each state are in thinking about evolving notions of equality. And in fact, that's where Justice Kennedy started in the Windsor case and the DOMA case. He said the people of New York have been chewing on this issue for a while, and they have an evolving understanding of the meaning of equality that was concretized in the change in our law allowing same-sex couples to marry about 2 years ago.
So what's your assessment? Is this a Brown versus Board of Ed moment that really begins something, or is this an acknowledgement of something that's been going on for a while in American society?
I guess I'd have to say yes, it's both. And your reference to Brown actually raises one of the more troubling aspects of, I think, the end of this Supreme Court's term, because what we see is the court at the same time putting to rest, I think forever, the idea that animus or disfavor for gay people is an acceptable and a legitimate reason for local, state, or the federal government to legislate. Right? That we can no longer enact laws that discriminate against gay people and pass constitutional muster. The court sees that as a problem, and I don't think we'll ever have to raise that question in the court again. But this happens at the exact same moment that the court doesn't seem to be able to see racism in our society any longer. It's as if they only have the ability to see one form of injustice at the same time. So many of us were hugely disappointed by what the court did in the Voting Rights Act case yesterday, what they did in some of the employment discrimination cases last week, and what may be the outcome of the affirmative action cases, the Fisher case. We don't know exactly how that will pan out. But the language of the Supreme Court in those race cases, in effect, said constitutionally important questions of racism are no longer as pressing as they used to be. But we're able to see constitutionally pressing issues of sexual orientation-based discrimination in a new way. And that disheartens me a great deal, that the court can't see both of those forms of social injustice at the same time.
Catherine Franke is a law professor and director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at the Columbia Law School. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Some personal reaction now from Sarah Gogan, a 24-year-old in San Francisco. Welcome, Sarah. So one of the more emotional pieces of the reaction on the steps of the court today were couples talking about how this would affect their children, the children that they've brought up during this period of time when they felt unequal to other families, other couples, and that this would have a real impact on them. You're one of those children.
Yes, I am. I am definitely the proud daughter of two fabulous gay dads who are actually over on the East Coast right now doing a couple interviews. So hello over to the East Coast.
Well, I've heard of the East Coast. That's where we're speaking to you from. So let's talk a little bit about that sense of being unequal. Did your parents have this feeling of being unequal when they adopted you? As you grew up, did you get a sense that your family was not like others in the eyes of the law?
Yes, definitely. I think for my dads, they were only the second successful open gay adoption in the state of California. So for them, they were sort of the trailblazers at the forefront. They got a lot of the heat, not only from their families and friends, but from the community and definitely from the government, you know, and their country as well. So when they were trying to adopt, it was a difficult time, and they experienced the injustice, even living in San Francisco in a place that you know, is so recognized for not only its gay community, but also just for being kind of a, you know, an open city. We still do experience homophobia here and injustice here. So I think for us growing up, it wasn't so much of an issue of me being like, oh, I'm so different than everybody else, because I grew up just like all of the other kids in my class. You know, I went to school. My dad's coached my sports teams. You know, we did prom. We do shopping. We do everything that every other family in the country seems to do. We were just treated differently in the eyes of the law. So today is sort of that marking moment of all the things that my dads have gone through together as a couple and everything that we've gone through as a family, that it's sort of kind of come down to this moment, and it's exciting, it's nerve-wracking, but it's a great step towards, you know, full equality in the future.
Sarah, how does it feel not to have to be a trailblazer anymore? I can imagine that there must have been a lot of pressure on you that, boy, this adoption has to work out or else a whole lot goes down the tubes here.
Yes, I think, and not just for me, I know a lot of kids in my generation whose parents were sort of, you know, like you said, trailblazers at the forefront. It's kind of a relief to be able to pass down the torch, you know, to the next generation and be like, now it's your turn to teach others that your family is just the same. And it's a sense of relief and a sense of everything that we have done, you know, is it worked, and everything that we've done is worth it.
And you can suddenly be free, I mean, from your perspective, to fight with your dads without worrying that someone's going to give it some moral overtone here.
Yes. Yes, I think in the past we tried not to sort of not to sort of let that kind of stuff bring us down as a family, and sort of use that to kind of empower us and to help us be stronger individuals. So I think today is just, again, a day of celebration.
And you're 24, right?
Yes, I am.
And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, you've gone from trailblazer to this. I think with these two decisions, I mean, is rapidly becoming no big deal, except in maybe certain pockets of the country. I mean, in your lifetime, you've seen this transformation.
Yes, yes. I mean, growing up, even in San Francisco, I went to Catholic grammar school and Catholic high school. And so for me and my dad, we were the only ones, you know, the only sort of quote unquote different family in that respect. And so today is just, it's a day to kind of remember what we had gone through and just sort of move forward.
Do you remember the Defense of Marriage Act being passed, the debates over it, you know, what happened back in the 90s?
No, you know, my parents tried to keep me sort of out of that, out of a lot of what was going on when that was being ruled. I think for them, they didn't want me to see the negative effects that can come out of, such a big decision, a big ruling.
President Clinton signed that.
I know.
Isn't that amazing?
It is, and to see how opinions and you know, emotions can change in such a short period of time, even from somebody who signed something to now changing their opinion, changing their decision.
They shielded you from a lot.
They did. They did.
I mean, that would have been the president basically saying your family is illegitimate.
I think they had a feeling that I might have a little temper when I was a little younger and not really sure how to handle it. Maybe at the time I wasn't able to fully understand everything that was going on. And I think they wanted to let me know that, you know, they were okay and not to worry about them, that we were still a family and not government, not anybody else would be able to tear that apart.
Well, you did it.
Yes, they did it.
You guys all together did it.
Yes.
You feel a burden lifted? You feel a little light on your feet today?
I do. I do. It was an exciting commute to work. I take public transportation, so everybody on the bus was on their phones, checking everything. So it's a lot of excitement going on in the city and a lot of excitement in our family as well.
Well, Sarah, thanks so much.
No problem. Thank you.
Congratulations. And say hey to your dads for us.
Will do. Thank
Sarah
you.
Gogan's fathers adopted her in 1988. She was one of the first gay adoptions in California. She's now 24 years old. We want to hear from you about the Supreme Court's decisions. President Obama released this statement. We are a people who declared that we are all created equal and the love we commit to one another must be equal as well. Republican Senator John Cornyn said this, though, the issue is not going away and there are going to be havens of traditional values like Texas where I don't think the law is going to be changed. More on the politics of same-sex marriage later this hour. Your reaction on these cases, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Coming up, the leaker who inspired Edward Snowden. Stay with us. So does Edward Snowden, self-styled champion of the truth, or felonious leaker accused of espionage, however you think of him, does he have the U.S. government over a barrel right now? Or are the options diminishing for Snowden, reportedly haunting the Moscow airport, avoiding sovereign soil, apparently trying to make his way to Ecuador for political asylum? Joining us now is someone who has expressed open support and admiration for Snowden, and someone Snowden claims is a mentor for his own actions. Like Edward Snowden, Thomas Drake is also a former NSA employee who found electronic surveillance of American citizens both widespread and reprehensible. Thomas Drake, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, your experience was shortly after 9/11, and you observed the surveillance that came out in the New York Times, the James Risen reports and other reports, and you were in a position to be outraged by what was going on back then.
Well, I certainly was, as I've said it in other fora. I was present at the beginning, and to my horror, realized that the United States had crossed the Rubicon, had opened up the Pandora's box, and was subverting the Constitution, essentially rescinding the Fourth Amendment and violating the standing statute at the time, which was the exclusive means by which you could violate the Fourth Amendment rights of U.S. persons, and that was called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. They just completely abandoned it after 9/11. And President Bush signed a secret directive, which has never been made public, in the first week of October of 2001. And I knew if I remained silent that I'd be complicit as an accessory to a crime. And so I chose to blow the whistle many, many times within the system over several years before I ultimately made a fateful decision to go to reporter in 2006 with what I knew.
Why, in your particular case, was the sequence of the reporter the last person you contacted, as opposed to in the Snowden case, it appears to have been the Guardian was the among the first people he contacted?
Well, I think he learned the lessons of those, including me, who had preceded him. And I was completely exposed within the system. But I did exercise every channel available to me in terms of blowing the whistle under what was called the Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act. It actually exposed me. It didn't really help in terms of disclosures themselves. But you're talking about super secret programs. You're talking about government, as I have called them, high crimes and misdemeanors. I knew I was dealing with the very tippy top of the establishment, up to and including the President of the United States. And, you know, there was a point after all, and see, I was a material witness on two 9/11 investigations as well, in which I provided them all the information I knew at the time about those surveillance programs. So none of this is new to me. What is new is, and because I had never seen them, although I was certainly aware of them and knew of their existence, no one up until Snowden's disclosures had ever seen an actual order from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. That was definitely new, or had seen very specific documents detailing the mechanisms by which NSA had made special arrangements with certain companies to extract data about people.
You know, this is fascinating. Let me ask you one philosophical question, though, before we proceed on the similarities between your case and Snowden's case. Do you mind?
No, go ahead.
The government, in attempting to justify its behavior here, says that there's a nature of the sort of data domain, the digital domain, that it needs to be able to monitor the whole thing all at once, that the sort of old system of subpoenas and probable cause doesn't really work in this digital domain. And it's more like, you know, having radar coverage of your airspace. It's not the same kind of thing as the old, you know, FBI wiretaps. What's your response to that?
Well, it's a government meme. I mean, they say that because it's an excuse for them to gain access to everything. I mean, this is the thing that Senator Frank Church warned the nation about in 1975, that if, you know, with advances of technology, if NSA turned itself on the U.S., no one would be safe. There would be no safeguards because they could monitor everything and essentially know everything. That's the real risk. The technology to provide the protection under the Fourth Amendment was actually there. It's important to note but NSA chose to ignore it, abandon it, because they simply wanted no accountability. I think it's important for your listeners to understand these programs have been operating the deepest of secrecy. If there was simply just a radar system, right, as an early warning system, then why do they have to hide behind secrecy? Why do they have to hide behind executive rules that they don't even make fully available to Congress itself?
All right. Good point there. Good answer. I'll, while I'm contemplating that, let me ask you the question. In the end, it seemed as though the government was bluffing in their prosecution of you. You pleaded guilty to a very small charge in the end. And while the harassment, I'm sure, was painful over the years that you've described, in the end, they really didn't have anything on you.
No, but see, it didn't matter. I mean, they charged me with espionage. It's one of the most egregious things you can charge an American with. I mean, it paints you into a very dark corner. It's become the statute of choice when going after truth tellers and whistleblowers, holding up the mirror to the government. The bottom line is there was very few people that knew about the surveillance program. I also blew a whistle on massive multi-billion-dollar fraud and what NSA could have known, should have known, or didn't share with respect to 9/11 intelligence. They were ticked off. There's no question. But they wanted to hide their malfeasance. They wanted to hide the fact that they didn't feel that law was sufficient enough, and they had to break it in secret and then use the cover of secrecy and classification to hide it all from the American public.
All right. So Snowden, in disclosing this, you say, has learned the lessons, the things you got wrong. And his approach right now is, you say, or believe, the smart one.
Well, I don't know if it's got it wrong. I mean, it's clear. When you speak truth to or of power is a very dangerous act these days. In fact, in my case was example, you know, prime example number one, exhibit number one. It's not only dangerous, we're going to come after you with everything we've got. We're going to destroy your life. You realize that if he was remaining in the United States on a disclosure to the press, that his chances of remaining free in the U.S. would be a very, very short period of time. And so in order to remain free, his best chances to do so was to escape the United States.
Right. Okay. Let me ask you a final question here. And this is something that kind of disturbs me. Now, your background is in intelligence, right?
Yes.
You support an intelligence service as a defensive front line in the United States, posture in the world, right?
Yes, I do.
It's something that we need to have.
Yes.
Now, Edward Snowden says that he learned of your experience, admired your experience, describes you as something of a model, right?
Yes.
This looks suspiciously like he saw what you did back after 9/11. He realized he had some of the same expertise that you had. He decided to get hired by the NSA and Booz Allen to basically take down this system. That seems plausible here. Would you have a problem with that if that's the story?
Well, I mean, I've heard that. There's been a lot of – the focus has been on him. I continue to focus simply on his disclosures. I actually focus less on him as a person than what he's disclosed. And what he's disclosed is a vast systemic industrial-scale Leviathan surveillance
system. I understand, but you're dodging the question. If he did this as a takedown, it's a little different than just disclosing something that you noticed in the course of your work.
You know, you're using a very strong word, takedown. It'd be actually quite admirable if, in fact, that's part of the motivation is to join this, to join based on what he had been hearing, what he had heard, and what had been already disclosed to date. The fact is, we have an out of control surveillance system, and it needs to be reined in.
But is there a difference between you noticing something in the course of your intelligence work and him strategically deciding to get on board so he can take something like this down?
Yeah, I don't know if that's the actual fact. I remember he had been at CIA, he had been at other contractors. So when you say coming on board, you're entering into a realm for me right now without having any other information is speculative.
It's totally speculative, but you would recognize that that's different than what you did.
Well, I don't know if it's different in terms of outcome. I mean, it's... You know, I had access to all kinds of things, okay? I was accused myself of operating on behalf of others. So for me, it's actually no different. It just so happened, I was hired in under a special program. NSA later said they regretted that I was ever hired. In fact, the person who was my hiring manager, even before I came on board NSA, was wondering, do you really want to join NSA? There was concerns about bringing anybody in from the outside. I understand the question you're asking, but I mean, this is one of the things, this is what the government is now referring to as the insider threat. I mean, I became an insider threat by virtue of the actions I took, even within the system.
But what if Edward Snowden was someone working for the Chinese government, right?
You're in a realm of speculation.
No, but what I'm saying is this something the U.S. needs to defend against? Outsiders who come in and take down the system from the inside?
They've had programs for decades. I'm well aware of the programs, the standard programs they've had to detect quote unquote insider threats. It's just they're taking it to a whole new level. But that's a government mean because they need to deflect on what was actually disclosed. They're desperate. They're desperate to not have the conversation about the fact that they themselves are engaged in criminal activity. They themselves have been in violation of statute law for a long, long time. Remember, I was there before any of the Enabling Act legislation was actually passed.
Right, right. Well, crazy times, eh, Thomas Drake?
Yeah.
What do you think is going to happen to Snowden? You think they're going to grab him off the streets somewhere?
Well... I mean, I have some kinship for him, and I would want him to remain free from the clutches of the United States. I saw what they did to me while I was within the United States. They obviously want to take him off the street. There are means by which, you know, some have suggested in more dark conversations that there are, in fact, some have even have considered that as an option.
You know what those means are. As an NSA employee, you know what those means are, right?
Yeah, I used to work at the CIA. I'm well aware of certain operations and cutouts that could be used to take people out if they feel the threat's that great. But, you know, you're talking about an American citizen. But he's already been painted as a traitor. I mean, you've got any number of politicians, both, you know, former and current, and other officials who are calling for his head. But they called for my head. I mean, they said that what I did endangered the lives of soldiers. They said that if NSA went dark, I would have the blood of soldiers on my very hands. So I understand where they want to take him. And there are those who would like to take him out.
Thomas Drake, thanks for speaking with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thomas Drake is a former senior executive at the NSA and leaker of details about an NSA surveillance program known as the Trailblazer Project, years before the Snowden affair. You might say it was a showdown in Texas last night.
There will be lawsuits if this law were to go into if this bill were to go into law.
Wendy Davis, a Democratic lawmaker in the Texas legislature, starts a filibuster to stop a restrictive abortion bill.
Senate Bill 5 would prohibit an abortion past 20 weeks of gestation, and that gestational age itself, there's some argument about the way it's defined in the bill.
You can hear her weariness there. She goes on for 11 hours.
The consequence of the ambulatory surgical center provision of SB 5 will decrease in a fairly dramatic form the number of centers at which abortions can and will be provided in Texas.
Talking, and then she gets stymied on a procedural matter, at which point her colleague, Senator Letitia Van Depute, addresses the chair with a crowded Capitol full of onlookers at nearly 10 minutes to midnight last night.
Mr. President, parliamentary inquiry.
The state's your inquiry.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
That chanting and chaos from the onlookers there in the rotunda pushed off the vote on the bill until after midnight, at which point the whole thing goes down in a blaze of procedural self-destruction. Joining us now to help decipher what goes on there in the Texas legislature is Christy Hoppe, Austin Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Christy, welcome.
Thank you, John.
Also with us, James Henson, Director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas, Austin. James, welcome.
Hi, John.
So, Christy, what happened? I don't exactly know. They missed a deadline. Now the bill goes away, but this is a political victory. It seems a little procedural to me.
Procedural, but it's also a strong victory for Democrats who have very few of them in Texas. They are greatly outnumbered. They took a stand. They brought thousands of people unseen before to the Capitol, and they walked away with a very, very precious victory for them.
So, James Henson, does this mean from now on a close vote or actually on a vote where you have absolutely no chance, you just bring thousands of people with megaphones to the rotunda and filibuster until about 10 minutes to midnight?
Well, I think right now that's the fear of some of the Capitol insiders who, frankly, you know, on the floor of the Senate, in particular the senators themselves, look a little like deer in the headlight last night as the gallery erupted. I mean, I think on one hand, that's what people are going to be worried about. On the other hand, that's not very easy to do. As Christy kind of suggests, this was a real organizational coup for the Democrats to some degree, but also for women's health and pro-choice groups. Planned Parenthood has been under siege in Texas for, you know, the last couple of sessions as Republicans have systematically tried to kind of undermine them as an organization, both as a health organization, as a political organization. Their national president, Cecile Richards, flew to Austin, was in Texas in the lead up to this. So on one hand, maybe you do see this happen a little more often. On the other hand, it was a pretty singular event.
Christy Hoppe, do you get any sense from your reporting that this was a tactic that was kind of designed on some whiteboard somewhere and they tested it out in Texas, or did something sort of fall in their lap last night?
No, this was totally spontaneous. And it's the amazing realm what we're seeing, the changes brought by social media. Wendy Davis went from a few thousand followers on Twitter in the course of that day to well over 60,000 followers. And what you saw is, fed by that social media, people turned out. And that is the deer in the headlight look. The Republicans had never seen anything like this. They have commanded Texas for a long time. They have managed to work a very socially conservative agenda and done it fairly easily. So I think whether this could be replicated is really a long shot, but it struck a nerve, and it's certainly going to have political fallouts for David Dewhurst, who is presiding over the Senate, and it has made Wendy Davis into a national star.
James Henson, what does this do substantively to the national debate on abortion, do you think?
Well, I think it's a real shot in the arm. I think I think it's fair to say that across the country for the last several years, abortion rights advocates have been on the defensive. And this may be a temporary victory. It's very likely that the governor will call the legislature back and that they will entertain the bill again and try to ram it through. But it's a highly symbolic victory because the mobilization we're talking about has had great visuals for them and substantively shows that you can organize and you can make a difference.
And the visuals are pretty key here, James Henson. Christy Hoppe, respond to that. In a sense, if the Texas legislature and the Republican majorities try to ram this bill through again, it only illustrates the visuals that we got last night, in that here are two women standing up against a male-dominated approach to abortion, and that has real national credibility.
Right. And it's a picture that paints that thousand words. Governor Rick Perry is very pro-life. This is a very important issue to him. Whether he will spend more political capital to bring it back, he's never hesitated before. But again, I think it will take a little while for him to do it. I don't expect a back-to-back session like we've seen this time. I think he's going to let the flames die down a little bit before he tries this one.
Is that because the Republicans believe in Texas that, and nationally, that they're vulnerable on the question of women voters and that this doesn't help that at all, James Henson?
Well, I think that's true. I think that Republicans are thinking about women voters a little bit more, and there is a certain amount of sensitivity, political sensitivity there. But, I think on abortion, we're seeing a conversation not unlike the one we're seeing on immigration in the Republican Party. And the Republican Party is very split. There are, leaders and, for lack of a better term, elites in the Republican Party that think long term about things like demographics and trends. And then there are elected officials who think much more in the short term and think about the next election and think about Republican primary voters. And, Republican primary voters are relatively restrictive in their views about abortion. And so there's a powerful incentive for the politician looking at the next primary election to think primarily about that and not about 5, 10, 15 years down the road.
But they're a minority nationally, that's for sure. James Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas, Austin, and Christy Hoppe, Austin Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Here's a response from listener Brad in New Hampshire. Filibusters are democracy in action. No matter who it is or what it's over, this type of display is encouraging. It means that someone really cares and is passionate about the issue at hand. What do you think? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Hollywood, down through history, hasn't just been glitter, escapism, and mindless entertainment. Hollywood has also been trying to help. Trying to lend a hand to confront serious social problems in America.
Must be stopped. And you must stand united on this and stamp out this frightful assassin of our youth. On the subject of narcotics in general, the dread marijuana in particular, because it is only through enlightenment that this scourge can be wiped out.
We're still waiting for that scourge to be wiped out. And since Reefer Madness was made more than 75 years ago, Hollywood has found more profitable ways to look at the drug scourge.
It feels good in my brain.
Cops, cops, cops.
They called it Little Havana, where the American dream had a price tag.
and only one man in a million was hungry enough to pay.
This country, you gotta make the money first.
With heavy-handed morality tales like Reefer Madness, mob glorification movies like Scarface, and stoner movies like Pineapple Express, perhaps filmmakers need a fresh approach to the drug problem.
Are you unemployed or stuck in a dead-end job?
Thousands of people around the state are losing their jobs every day.
Are you homeless or living in a bad neighborhood?
Unemployment shot up to its highest level in nearly 26 years.
If the American dream broke its promise to you, don't worry. We have an answer.
How to make money selling drugs is a truly fresh look at the real drug culture in America. It's documentary film meets junior achievement business boosters. And it opens a very different window on people trying to get by in America while showing off the consequences of this country's war on drugs mentality. Produced by actor and Entourage star Adrian Grenier and directed by Matthew Cook, it's about entrepreneurs and the real madness behind the drugs and reefer game.
Well, How to Make Money Selling Drugs is a new approach to documentary filmmaking. We figured instead of marginalizing ourselves right out of the gate with a really boring didactic film, we said, you know what, let's make something fun that people are actually going to be compelled to see.
And is this an anti-prohibition movie, Matthew, would you say? Or is this a character study using a very provocative premise, how you can make money selling drugs?
I love the way you put it. I would say it's both. I mean, it's certainly a character study. These are incredible, extraordinary individuals who overcame challenges that most of us can't imagine overcoming and wound up finding their way into this drug dealing game, which only exists because of this black market prohibition against drugs.
Is this an American thing? I mean, does it all go together, America and the success in the drug trade?
Well, look, these are human stories, you know, and I think the war on drugs has done such a great job to villainize and demonize and put this, you know, very two-dimensional blanket, you know, definition of what a drug dealer is or a drug user. And the reality is there are as many diverse reasons why people turn to using drugs or dealing drugs as there are human individuals. So we're looking to sort of turn that around and start to show the human side of this story.
Matthew, who's a character who you believe is both a drug addict and just someone trying to make it in the tough world of America in this film?
In this film, I mean, Bobby Carlton is one, certainly.
Ninth grade. Up to that point, I was kind of a student that didn't participate. But then they were like, how many grams are in an ounce? And I was like, 28. They were like, how many pounds are in a kilo? I was like, 2.2. And do you want me to tell you how much that cost? Hence, everybody at school knew what I was up to that day.
But he's not the only one. I think people would be surprised to find out that majority of drug dealers are drug users themselves. It's the easiest way to put together a little bit of money to feed your own habit.
And tax-free, of course, which is another argument against prohibition, that if this were on the level, it would be a part of the regular economy and might be a more safer option for everyone concerned.
Sure. And I think that that needs to be discussed responsibly. You know, the United States hasn't necessarily done so well in the past with legal drugs in terms of the amount of marketing that they've allowed regarding alcohol or cigarettes, more likely.
Or prescription drugs.
Or prescription drugs were one of only two countries in the world that allows for pharmaceutical advertising on television, which I think is absurd. So we have to have a responsible approach to how we're going to address decriminalization. What we know is that addiction and drug abuse are one problem, and a totally separate problem are those that are created by the war on drugs.
When you look at people this way as characters, as people trying to make a living in America, do you immediately run into drug dealers who are trying to juggle a two-income family, get the kids off to school, deal with the schedule? Do you run into really familiar stuff at the same time as you run into some bizarre stuff?
Absolutely. And I think that is and was the objective of the film. And now that it's come out, for people to talk about the fact that we are not a nation divided between two types of people. One are these horrific criminals that need to be thrown in prison, and the other are this amazing group of goody-two-shoes citizens. We're all connected and a part of the issue. The United States is the largest consumer of cocaine and marijuana in the world, and we're not just talking about – these aren't just bank robbers who are doing these drugs. These are normal people. And plenty of the drug dealers that we ran into were trying to put food on the table for their families. They're just trying to find a way to make ends meet. And when you have unemployment, which is fixed at 8%, 10% in some parts of the country, Detroit, you know, up into the 20 percentile range at times, people have to find some way to make ends meet. And the black market for drugs provides this incredible safety net of sorts.
You know, the film business is all about positioning and message. I'm wondering, by taking the provocative how to make money selling drugs approach here, that you run the risk really of not being taken seriously by the very people who you want to start this responsible discussion. Rachel Maddows and the Chris Matthews of the world.
Well, we're trying to cut through the apathy, really. I mean, I think there's this malaise. You know, people just, you know, take it for granted. They assume that nothing's going to change. We're trying to liven things up, have straight talk, and get a different audience, a younger generation who might actually be able to make some real change when they get agitated. And that's what this is for, is for young people who are on the internet who don't want to be talked down to.
And we've come a long way from the reefer madness days.
Have we? I mean, we're still paranoid that if we don't legislate morality, if we don't use the hammer of criminal justice over the heads of addicts, that somehow everyone's going to go running out into the street and start doing heroin and cocaine. So I think we still have a reefer madness mentality, and it's built into the culture at this point.
I heard you laugh, but I can't imagine your mother was even born during reefer madness, Adrian.
Everybody knows reefer madness. Well, you know, it's interesting that that whole campaign was in black and white, because they try and make this issue black and white, you know, and they try and oversimplify it. But, you know, it's as complex as there are people, and we need to have a more nuanced approach to addressing human beings and the reasons why they make choices. You know, I mean, I think it could be argued that, you know, our mistakes are what make us humans, and our mistakes are what allow us to become the better humans that we ultimately are. And we need to allow people to make mistakes without throwing them in jail and really giving them opportunities to overcome, you know, maybe some hard times in their lives.
Going to stay in the entertainment business or get into drugs?
let's keep the drug of entertainment.
Adrian Gurnier and Matthew Cook, director of How to Make Money Selling Drugs. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. In his majority opinion striking down key provisions of the Voting Rights Act yesterday, Chief Justice John Roberts relied on his reading of history. History, he says, did not end in 1965, the year the Voting Rights Act was enacted. History since 1965, he says, cannot be ignored. Nearly 50 years later, things have changed dramatically, largely because of the Voting Rights Act, Roberts writes. Voter turnout and registration rates in covered jurisdictions now approach parity. Blatantly discriminatory evasions of federal decrees are rare, and minority candidates hold office at unprecedented levels. The Supreme Court often relies on social and historical data in making its judgments. In this case, Justice Roberts is saying 1965 has no bearing on the way people of different races interact politically today, and Congress needs to make a new formula. If Congress were to do that, what factors about today's more integrated or very differently segregated communities would it take into account? Dante Chinney, director of the American Communities Project, joins me now. Dante, welcome.
Hey, John.
So what would Congress look at if they wanted to update, as Roberts suggests, you know, history since 1965 in determining whether a district needs to consider preclearance, federal oversight for its voting practices?
Well, I think Roberts actually does strike on one thing that makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I spent a lot of time looking at numbers, and that's he talked about in 65, the United States was broken into states that basically had this history of problems and states that didn't. And I do think he hits on something of a point when he talks about states, because there are real differences. Even if you look at the states covered under the Voting Rights Act now, you had Alabama, Mississippi, and Virginia, and Texas. These states are very, very different, very different. I mean, Virginia has changed, you could say, remarkably since 65, and Alabama and Mississippi have changed, but less so. But I think bigger are the differences within those places. You really do have to go county by county to look at, or even maybe it's smaller, to look at what's going on. There, Shelby County, which they talked about in the rule, it's really what the case was about. Shelby County has changed dramatically in the last 10 years. I mean, its population has grown by a third. It's you know, it went from about 140,000 people to more than 200,000 people. It's gotten much more educated. It's gotten wealthier. You'd have to say, now what that means for Shelby County in terms of whether there's discrimination there, I don't know that for certain, but I can say that, you know, the numbers do indicate it's a changed place. I mean, to me, the factors that would be key in coming up with something like this would be obviously looking at the racial breakdown of a place, but also looking at income, education. And this is actually really important, how much actually the population has grown or really shrank in the last 10, 20 years, because that's what really brings change.
So Dante, if Shelby County passes a certain test, what would be a formula where you could look at, say, somewhere in Ohio or someplace in Massachusetts or Missouri that might fail the test?
Right. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. I think the thing to do is you have to compare Shelby County to places that demographically, theoretically, are like Shelby County, right? And to see what voter participation is like in Shelby and what the rules are like in Shelby compared to counties that are similar to Shelby in other states and other regions in the country. I think that would be, to me, that would be an interesting way of looking at the differences and whether or not there needs to be something special for a place like Shelby County or some of these other jurisdictions in the South.
So we can inaugurate here the Shelby County test, where that's the gold standard of a place with demographics that has really enacted changes in its voter participation rates. And if we're going to find places around the United States that have similar demographics but have not achieved what Shelby County has, then maybe that's where we would focus our formula.
Yeah, that seems to make sense to me, because what the court is saying is that they know, for at least for certain, that Shelby County in their eyes meets this test. So if that's the case, it is true that coming up with a formula, at least you have to say maybe Shelby isn't the marker, because I don't know Shelby specifically. I don't know the place specifically, but they're saying it meets the test. So the question is, would Shelby be the test, or do we have they basically, what we need to have is some kind of rule to say this is the place, this is the bottom line standard. Maybe Shelby is that place that you use for the test. Maybe it's some other county. But that's I think getting beyond states and getting to that level and looking at the changes in those places, that's a huge step.
And demographically, the data is out there. If Congress wanted to take this up, there was lots of talk yesterday about Congress will never do this. It's too politically sensitive. In fact, from your perspective, this is doable.
Oh, the data is out there. Oh, no, the data is out there. Now, I would think that obviously, along with these demographic tests, you're going to have the specifics about all these places and what exactly the rules are that people are trying to enforce upon people. But I do think that, you know, if you're talking about demographics, yeah, the data is all there. There's plenty of numbers to look at if Congress is interested in taking this seriously.
Dante Cheney is director of the American Communities Project. We spoke with him in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, John.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. Tell us what you think of it by leaving us a review on iTunes or by letting us know on Twitter or Facebook.